And what about this day of meditation? Campo didn't lie to us. The waiter said it was a day of meditation when we came in here and asked him. Yes, he did, but he said the restaurant wasn't closed. In fact, what he said was, Seychelles City isn't the backwoods. It doesn't close down. People meditate, in other words, but not in the big town, where everyone is sophisticated and there's no place for small-town piety. So there's traffic, and it's busy. Well, perhaps not quite as busy as on ordinary days, but busy. But, Colin, no one came into the tourist center while we were there. I was aware of that. Not one person entered. I noticed that, too. I even went to the window at one point and looked out and saw clearly that the streets around the center had a good scattering of people on foot and in vehicles, and yet not one person entered. The day of meditation made a good cover. We would not have questioned the fortunate privacy we had if I simply hadn't made up my mind not to trust that son of two strangers. Bellaret said, What is the significance of all this, then? I think it's simple, Genoff. We have here someone who knows where we're going as soon as we do, even though he and we are in separate spaceships, and we also have here someone who can keep a public building empty when it is surrounded by people, in order that we might talk in convenient privacy. Would you have me believe he can perform miracles? Certainly. If it so happens that Kumpor is an agent of the Second Foundation and can control minds, if he can read yours and mine in a distant spaceship, if he can influence his way through a customs station at once, if he can land gravitically with no border patrol outraged at his defiance of the radio beams, and if he can influence minds in such a way as to keep people from entering a building he doesn't want entered. By all the stars, Trevise went on with a marked air of grievance, I can even follow this back to graduation. I didn't go on the tour with him. I remember not wanting to. Wasn't that a matter of his influence? He had to be alone. Where was he really going? Pellaret pushed away the dishes before him, as though he wanted to clear a space about himself in order to have room to think. It seemed to be a gesture that signaled the busboy robot, a self-moving table that stopped near them and waited while they placed their dishes and cutlery upon it. When they were alone, Pellaret said, But that's mad. Nothing has happened that could not have happened naturally. Once you get it into your head that somebody is controlling events, you can interpret everything in that light and find no reasonable certainty anywhere. Come on, old fellow, it's all circumstantial and a matter of interpretation. Don't yield to paranoia. I'm not going to yield to complacency, either. Well, let's look at this logically. Suppose he was an agent of the Second Foundation. Why would he run the risk of rousing our suspicions by keeping the tourist center empty? What did he say that was so important that a few people at a distance, who would have been wrapped in their own concerns anyway, would have made a difference? There's an easy answer to that, Genoff. He would have to keep our minds under close observation, and he wanted no interference from other minds, no static, no chance of confusion. Again, just your interpretation. What was so important about his conversation with us? It would make sense to suppose, as he himself insisted, that he met us only in order to explain what he had done, to apologize for it, and to warn us of the trouble that might await us. Why would we have to look further than that? The small card receptacle at the farther rim of the table glittered unobtrusively, and the figures representing the cost of the meal flashed briefly. Trevise groped beneath his sash for his credit card, which, with its Foundation imprint, was good anywhere in the galaxy, or anywhere a Foundation citizen was likely to go. He inserted it in the appropriate slot. It took a moment to complete the transaction, and Trevise, with native caution, checked on the remaining balance before returning it to its pocket. He looked about casually to make sure there was no undesirable interest in him on the faces of any of the few who still sat in the restaurant, and then said, Why look further than that? Why look further? That was not all he talked about. He talked about Earth. He told us it was dead, and urged us very strongly to go to Camporeon. Shall we go? It's something I've been considering, Golan, admitted Pellaret. Just leave here? We can come back after we check out the Sirius sector. It doesn't occur to you that his whole purpose in seeing us was to deflect us from Seychelles and get us out of here, get us anywhere but here? Why? I don't know. See here, they expected us to go to Trantor. That was what you wanted to do, and maybe that's what they counted on us doing. I messed things up by insisting we go to Seychelles, which is the last thing they wanted, and so now they have to get us out of here. Pellaret looked distinctly unhappy. But, Golan, you are just making statements. Why don't they want us on Seychelles? I don't know, Genoff, but it's enough for me that they want us out. I'm staying here. I'm not going to leave. But, look, Golan, if the Second Foundation wanted us to leave, wouldn't they just influence our minds to make us want to leave? Why bother reasoning with us? Now that you bring up the point, haven't they done that in your case, Professor? And Trevise's eyes narrowed in sudden suspicion. Don't you want to leave? Pellaret looked at Trevise in surprise. I just think there's some sense to it. Of course you would, if you've been influenced. But I haven't been. Of course you would swear you hadn't been if you had been. Pellaret said, if you box me in this way, there's no way of disproving your bare assertion. What are you going to do? I will remain in Seychelles, and you'll stay here too. You can't navigate the ship without me, so if Kampor has influenced you, he has influenced the wrong one. Very well, Golan. We'll stay in Seychelles until we have independent reasons to leave. The worst thing we can do, after all, worse than either staying or going, is to fall out with each other. Come, old chap, if I had been influenced, would I be able to change my mind and go along with you cheerfully, as I plan to do now? Trevise thought for a moment, and then, as though with an inner shake, smiled and held out his hand. Agreed, Janoff. Now, let's get back to the ship and make another start tomorrow, if we can think of one. 47. Munley Kampor did not remember when he had been recruited. For one thing, he had been a child at the time. For another, the agents of the Second Foundation were meticulous in removing their traces as far as that was possible. Kampor was an observer, and to a Second Foundationer, he was instantly recognizable as such. It meant that Kampor was acquainted with mentalics and could converse with Second Foundationers in their own fashion to a degree, but he was in the lowest rank of the hierarchy. He could catch glimpses of minds, but he could not adjust them. The education he had received had never gone that far. He was an observer, not a doer. It made him second class at best, but he did not mind much. He knew his importance in the scheme of things. During the early centuries of the Second Foundation, it had underestimated the task before it. It had imagined that its handful of members could monitor the entire galaxy, and that Selden's plan to be maintained would require only the most occasional, the lightest touch here and there. The mule had stripped them of these delusions. Coming from nowhere, he had caught the Second Foundation, and of course the First, though that didn't matter, utterly by surprise, and had left them helpless. It took 5 years before a counterattack could be organized, and then only at the cost of a number of lives. With Palver, a full recovery was made, again at a distressing cost, and he finally took the appropriate measures. The operations of the Second Foundation, he decided, must be enormously expanded, without at the same time increasing the chances of detection unduly, so he instituted the Corps of Observers. Kampor did not know how many observers were in the galaxy, or even how many there were on Terminus. It was not his business to know. Ideally, there should be no detectable connection between any two observers, so that the loss of one would not entail the loss of any other. All connections were with the upper echelons on Trantor. It was Kampor's ambition to go to Trantor someday. Though he thought it extremely unlikely, he knew that occasionally an observer might be brought to Trantor and promoted, but that was rare. The qualities that made for a good observer were not those that pointed toward the table. There was Jendabal, for instance, who was 4 years younger than Kampor. He must have been recruited as a boy, just as Kampor was, but he had been taken directly to Trantor and was now a speaker. Kampor had no illusions as to why that should be. He had been much in contact with Jendabal of late, and he had experienced the power of that young man's mind. He could not have stood up against it for a second. Kampor was not often conscious of a lowly status. There was almost never occasion to consider it. After all, as in the case of other observers, he imagined, it was only lowly by the standards of Trantor. On their own non-Trantorian worlds, in their own non-mentalic societies, it was easy for observers to obtain high status. Kampor, for instance, had never had trouble getting into good schools or finding good company. He had been able to use his mentalics in a simple way to enhance his natural intuitive ability. That natural ability had been why he had been recruited in the first place, he was sure. And in this way, to prove himself a star at hyperspatial pursuit. He became a hero at college, and this set his foot on the first rung of a political career. Once this present crisis was over, there was no telling how much farther he might advance. If the crisis resolved itself successfully, as surely it would it not be recalled that it was Kampor who had first noted Trevise, not as a human being, anyone could have done that, but as a mind? He had encountered Trevise in college, and had seen him at first only as a jovial and quick-witted companion. One morning, however, he had stirred sluggishly out of slumber, and in the stream of consciousness that accompanied the never-never land of half-sleep, he felt what a pity it was that Trevise had never been recruited. Trevise couldn't have been recruited, of course, since he was Terminus-born, and not, like Kampor, a native of another world. And even with that aside, it was too late. Only the quite young are plastic enough to receive an education into mentalics. The painful introduction of that art, it was more than a science, into adult brains, set rustily in their mold, was a thing of the first two generations after Selden only. But then, if Trevise had been ineligible for recruiting in the first place, and had outlived the possibility in the second, what had roused Compore's concern over the matter? On their next meeting, Compore had penetrated Trevise's mind deeply, and discovered what it was that must have initially disturbed him. Trevise's mind had characteristics that did not fit the rules he had been taught. Over and over it eluded him. As he followed its workings, he found gaps. No, they couldn't be actual gaps, actual leaps of non-existence. They were places where Trevise's manner of mind dove too deeply to be followed. Compore had no way of determining what this meant, but he watched Trevise's behavior in the light of what he had discovered, and he began to suspect that Trevise had an uncanny ability to reach right conclusions from what would seem to be insufficient data. Did this have something to do with the gaps? Surely this was a matter for mentalism beyond his own powers, for the table itself, perhaps. He had the uneasy feeling that Trevise's powers of decision were unknown in their full to the man himself, and that he might be able to... To do what? Compore's knowledge did not suffice. He could almost see the meaning of what Trevise possessed, but not quite. There was only the intuitive conclusion, or perhaps just a guess, that Trevise might be potentially a person of the utmost importance. He had to take the chance that this might be so, and to risk seeming to be less than qualified for his post. After all, if he were correct, he was not sure, looking back on it, how he had managed to find the courage to continue his efforts. He could not penetrate the administrative barriers that ringed the table. He had all but reconciled himself to a broken reputation. He had worked himself down, despairingly, to the most junior member of the table. And finally, Storr Gendebald had responded to his call. Gendebald had listened patiently, and from that time on there had been a special relationship between them. It was on Gendebald's behalf that Compore had maintained his relationship with Trevise, and on Gendebald's direction that he had carefully set up the situation that had resulted in Trevise's exile. And it was through Gendebald that Compore might yet, he was beginning to hope, achieve his dream of promotion to Trantor. All preparations, however, had been designed to send Trevise to Trantor. Trevise's refusal to do this had taken Compore entirely by surprise, and, Compore thought, had been unforeseen by Gendebald as well. At any rate, Gendebald was hurrying to the spot, and to Compore that deepened the sense of crisis. Compore sent out his hypersignal. 48. Gendebald was roused from his sleep by the touch on his mind. It was effective and not in the least disturbing. Since it affected the arousal center directly, he simply awoke. He sat up in bed, the sheet falling from his well-shaped and smoothly muscular torso. He had recognized the touch. The differences were as distinctive to mentalists as were voices to those who communicated primarily by sound. Gendebald sent out the standard signal, asking if a small delay were possible, and the no-emergency call returned. Without undue haste, then, Gendebald attended to the morning routine. He was still in the ship's shower, with the used water draining into the recycling mechanisms when he made contact again. Compore?
Yes, Speaker.
Have you spoken with Trevise and the other one?
Pellerat. Yanov Pellerat. Yes, Speaker.
Good. Give me another 5 minutes and I'll arrange visuals. He passed Suranovi on his way to the controls. She looked at him questioningly and made as though to speak, but he placed a finger on his lips and she subsided at once. Gendebald still felt a bit uncomfortable at the intensity of adoration-respect in her mind, but it was coming to be a comfortingly normal part of his environment somehow. He had hooked a small tendril of his mind to hers, and there would now be no way to affect his mind without affecting hers. The simplicity of her mind, and there was an enormous aesthetic pleasure to be found in contemplating its unadorned symmetry, Gendebald couldn't help thinking, made it impossible for any extraneous minefield to exist in their neighborhood without detection. He felt a surge of gratitude for the courteous impulse that had moved him that moment they had stood together outside the university, and that had led her to come to him precisely when she could be most useful. He said, "Compore?"
"Yes, Speaker?"
"Relax, please. I must study your mind. No offense is intended."
"As you wish, Speaker. May I ask the purpose?"
"To make certain you are untouched."
Compore said, "I know you have political adversaries at the table, Speaker, but surely none of them..."
"Do not speculate, Compore. Relax." "Yes, you are untouched.
Now, if you will cooperate with me, we will establish visual contact." What followed was, in the ordinary sense of the word, an illusion, since no one but someone who was aided by the mentalic power of a well-trained second foundationer would have been able to detect anything at all, either by the senses or by any physical detecting device. It was the building up of a face and its appearance from the contours of a mind, and even the best mentalist could succeed in producing only a shadowy and somewhat uncertain figure. Kompor's face was there in mid-space, as though it were seen through a thin but shifting curtain of gauze, and Gendebal knew that his own face appeared in an identical manner in front of Kompor. By physical hyperwave, communication could have been established through images so clear that speakers who were 1,000 parsecs apart might judge themselves to be face-to-face. Gendebal's ship was equipped for the purpose. There were, however, advantages to the mentalist vision. The chief was that it could not be tapped by any device known to the First Foundation. Nor, for that matter, could one second foundationer tap the mentalist vision of another. The play of mind might be followed, but not the delicate change of facial expression that gave the communication its finer points. As for the anti-mules, well, the purity of Novi's mind was sufficient to assure him that none were about. He said, "Tell me precisely, Kompor, the talk you had with Trevise and with this Pellerat, precisely to the level of mind."
"Of course, Speaker," said Kompor.
It didn't take long. The combination of sound, expression, and mentalism compressed matters considerably, despite the fact that there was far more to tell at the level of mind than if there had been a mere parroting of speech. Gendebal watched intently. There was little redundancy, if any, in mentalist vision. In true vision, or even in physical hypervision across the parsecs, one saw enormously more in the way of information bits than was absolutely necessary for comprehension, and one could miss a great deal without losing anything significant. Through the gauze of mentalist vision, however, one bought absolute security at the price of losing the luxury of being able to miss bits. Every bit was significant. There were always horror tales that passed from instructor to student on Trantor, tales that were designed to impress on the young the importance of concentration. The most often repeated was certainly the least reliable. It told of the first report on the progress of the mule before he had taken over Kalgan, of the minor official who received the report and who had no more than the impression of a horse-like animal because he did not see or understand the small flick that signified personal name. The official therefore decided that the whole thing was too unimportant to pass on to Trantor. By the time the next message came, it was too late to take immediate action, and 5 more bitter years had to pass. The event had almost certainly never happened, but that didn't matter. It was a dramatic story, and it served to motivate every student into the habit of intent concentration. Gendebal remembered his own student days when he made an error in reception that seemed in his own mind to be both insignificant and understandable. His teacher, old Kendast, a tyrant to the roots of his cerebellum, had simply sneered and said, "A horse-like animal, Cub Gendebal?" And that had been enough to make him collapse in shame. Kompor finished. Gendebal said, "Your estimate, please, of Trevise's reaction. You know him better than I do, better than anyone does." Kompor said,
"It was clear enough. The mentalic indications were unmistakable. He thinks my words and actions represent my extreme anxiety to have him go to Trantor, or to the Sirius sector, or to any place but where, in fact, he is actually going. It meant, in my opinion, that he would remain firmly where he was. The fact that I attached great importance to his shifting his position, in short, forced him to give it the same importance, and since he feels his own interest to be diametrically opposed to mine, he will deliberately act against what he interprets to be my wish."
"You are certain of that?"
"Quite certain."
Gendebal considered this and decided that Kompor was correct. He said, "I am satisfied. You have done well. Your tale of Earth's radioactive destruction was cleverly chosen to help produce the proper reaction without the need for direct manipulation of the mind. Commendable." Kompor seemed to struggle with himself a short moment.
"Speaker," he said, "I cannot accept your praise. I did not invent the tale. It is true. There really is a planet called Earth in the Sirius sector, and it really is considered to be the original home of humanity. It was radioactive, either to begin with or eventually, and this grew worse till the planet died. There was indeed a mind-enhancing invention that came to nothing. All this is considered history on the home planet of my ancestors."
"So? Interesting," said Gendebal with no obvious conviction. "And better yet, to know when a truth will do is admirable, since no non-truth can be presented with the same sincerity. Palver once said, 'The closer to the truth, the better the lie, and the truth itself, when it can be used, is the best lie.'
Kampur said. There is one thing more to say. In following instructions to keep Trevise in the Seychelles sector until you arrived, and to do so at all costs, I had to go so far in my efforts that it is clear that he suspects me of being under the influence of the Second Foundation.
Gendebel nodded. That, I think, is unavoidable under the circumstances. His monomania on the subject would be sufficient to have him see Second Foundation, even where it was not. We must simply take that into account.
Speaker, if it is absolutely necessary that Trevise stay where he is until you can reach him, it would simplify matters if I came to meet you, took you aboard my ship, and brought you back. It would take less than a day.
No, observer, said Gendebel sharply. You will not do this. The people on Terminus know where you are. You have a hyper-relay on your ship which you cannot remove, have you not?
Yes, Speaker.
And if Terminus knows you have landed on Seychelles, their ambassador on Seychelles knows of it, and the ambassador knows also that Trevise has landed. Your hyper-relay will tell Terminus that you have left for a specific point hundreds of parsecs away and returned, and the ambassador will inform them that Trevise has, however, remained in the sector. From this, how much will the people at Terminus guess? The mayor of Terminus is, by all accounts, a shrewd woman, and the last thing we want to do is to alarm her by presenting her with an obscure puzzle. We don't want her to lead a section of her fleet here. The chances of that are, in any case, uncomfortably high.
Kampur said, With respect, Speaker, what reason do we have to fear a fleet if we can control a commander?
However little reason there might be, there is still less reason to fear if the fleet is not here. You stay where you are, observer. When I reach you, I will join you on your ship. And then?
And then, Speaker?
Why, and then I will take over.
49. Gendebel sat in place after he dismantled the Ventalist vision and stayed there for long minutes, considering. During this long trip to Seychelles, unavoidably long in this ship of his, which could in no way match the technological advancement of the products of the First Foundation, he had gone over every single report on Trevise. The reports had stretched over nearly a decade. Seen as a whole, and in the light of recent events, there was no longer any doubt Trevise would have been a marvelous recruit for the Second Foundation, if the policy of never touching the Terminus-born had not been in place since Palver's time. There was no telling how many recruits of highest quality had been lost to the Second Foundation over the centuries. There was no way of evaluating every one of the quadrillions of human beings populating the galaxy. None of them was likely to have had more promise than Trevise, however, and certainly none could have been in a more sensitive spot. Gendebel shook his head slightly. Trevise should never have been overlooked, Terminus-born or not, and credit to Observer Kampur for seeing it, even after the years it distorted him. Trevise was of no use to them now. Of course, he was too old for the molding, but he still had that inborn intuition, that ability to guess a solution on the basis of totally inadequate information, and something... Old Chandis, who, despite being past his prime, was first speaker and had, on the whole, been a good one, saw something there, even without the correlated data and the reasoning that Gendebel had worked out in the course of this trip. Trevise, Chandis had thought, was the key to the crisis. Why was Trevise here at Seychelles? What was he planning? What was he doing? And he couldn't be touched. Of that Gendebel was sure. Until it was known precisely what Trevise's role was, it would be totally wrong to try to modify him in any way. With the anti-mules, whoever they were, whatever they might be in the field, a wrong move with respect to Trevise above all, might explode a wholly unexpected microsun in their faces. He felt a mind hovering about his own, and absently brushed at it, as he might at one of the more annoying Trantorian insects, though with mind rather than hand. He felt the instant wash of other pain, and looked up. Soranovi had her palm to her furrowed brow.
Your pardon, master, I be struck with sudden head anguish.
Gendebel was instantly contrite. I'm sorry, Novi, I wasn't thinking, or I was thinking too intently. Instantly and gently, he smoothed the ruffled mind tendrils. Novi smiled with sudden brightness.
It passed with sudden vanishing. That kind sound of your words, master, works well upon me.
Gendebel said, Good. Is something wrong? Why are you here? He forbore to enter her mind in greater detail in order to find out for himself. More and more, he felt a reluctance to invade her privacy. Novi hesitated. She leaned toward him slightly.
I be concerned. You are looking at nothing and making sounds, and your face was twitching. I stayed there, stick frozen, afeard you were declining, ill, and unknowing what to do.
It was nothing, Novi. You are not to fear. He patted her nearer hand. There is nothing to fear. Do you understand?
Fear, or any strong emotion, twisted and spoiled the symmetry of her mind somewhat. He preferred it calm and peaceful and happy, but he hesitated at the thought of adjusting it into that position by outer influence.
She had felt the previous adjustment to be the effect of his words, and it seemed to him that he preferred it that way. He said, "Novi, why don't I call you Sura?" She looked up at him in sudden woe.
"Oh, master, do not do so."
"But Rufiran did so on that day that we met. I know you well enough now."
"I know well he did so, master. It be how a man speak to a girl who have no man, no betrothed, who is not complete. You say her previous. It is more honorable for me if you say Novi, and I be proud that you say so. And if I have not man now, I have master, and I be pleased. I hope it be not offensive to you to say Novi."
"It certainly isn't, Novi." And her mind was beautifully smooth at that, and Jandabal was pleased. Too pleased. Ought he to be so pleased? A little shamefacedly, he remembered that the mule was supposed to have been affected in this manner by that woman of the first foundation, Beta Darrell, to his own undoing. This, of course, was different. This Hamish woman was his defense against alien minds, and he wanted her to serve that purpose most efficiently. No, that was not true. His function as a speaker would be compromised if he ceased to understand his own mind, or worse, if he deliberately misconstrued it to avoid the truth. The truth was that it pleased him when she was calm and peaceful and happy endogenously, without his interference, and that it pleased him simply because she pleased him. And, he thought defiantly, there was nothing wrong with that. He said, "Sit down, Novi." She did so, balancing herself precariously at the edge of the chair and sitting as far away as the confines of the room allowed. Her mind was flooded with respect. He said, "When you saw me making sounds, Novi, I was speaking at a long distance, scholar fashion." Novi said sadly, her eyes cast down,
"I see, master, that there be much to scholar fashion I understand not and imagine not. It be difficult mountain high art. I be ashamed to have come to you to be made scholar. How is it, master, you did not belaugh me?"
Chendabal said, "It is no shame to aspire to something, even if it is beyond your reach. You are now too old to be made a scholar after my fashion, but you are never too old to learn more than you already know, and to become able to do more than you already can. I will teach you something about this ship. By the time we reach our destination, you will know quite a bit about it." He felt delighted. Why not? He was deliberately turning his back on the stereotype of the Hamish people. What right, in any case, had the heterogeneous group of the Second Foundation to set up such a stereotype? The young produced by them were only occasionally suited to become high-level Second Foundationers themselves. The children of speakers almost never qualified to be speakers. There were the three generations of linguisters 3 centuries ago, but there was always the suspicion that the middle speaker of that series did not really belong. And, if that were true, who were the people of the university to place themselves on so high a pedestal? He watched Novi's eyes glisten, and was pleased that they did. She said,
"I try hard to learn all you teach me, master."
"I'm sure you will," he said, and then hesitated. It occurred to him that in his conversation with Kampor, he had in no way indicated at any time that he was not alone. There was no hint of a companion. A woman could be taken for granted, perhaps. At least Kampor would no doubt not be surprised. But a Hamish woman? For a moment, despite anything Jandabal could do, the stereotype reigned supreme, and he found himself glad that Kampor had never been on Trantor and would not recognize Novi as a Hamish woman. He shook it off. It didn't matter if Kampor knew or knew not, or if anyone did. Jandabal was a speaker of the Second Foundation, and he could do as he pleased within the constraints of the Zeldin Plan, and no one could interfere. Novi said,
"Master, once we reach our destination, will we part?"
He looked at her and said, with perhaps more force than he intended, "We will not be separated, Novi." And the Hamish woman smiled shyly and looked for all the galaxy as though she might have been any woman. Chapter 13. University. 50. Pellerat wrinkled his nose when he and Trevise re-entered the far star. Trevise shrugged. "The human body is a powerful dispenser of odors. Recycling never works instantaneously, and artificial scents merely overlay. They do not replace.
And I suppose no two ships smell quite alike once they've been occupied for a period of time by different people."
"That's right. But did you smell Seychelle Planet after the first hour?"
"No,"
admitted Pellerat. "Well, you won't smell this after a while either. In fact, if you live in the ship long enough, you'll welcome the odor that greets you on your return as signifying home. And by the way, if you become a galactic rover after this, Genoff, you'll have to learn that it is impolite to comment on the odor of any ship, or for that matter, any world, to those who live on that ship or world. Between us, of course, it's all right."
"As a matter of fact, Golan, the funny thing is I do consider the Far Star home, at least its foundation made."
Pellerat smiled.
"You know, I never considered myself a patriot. I like to think I recognize only humanity as my nation,
but I must say that being away from the Foundation fills my heart with love for it."
Trevise was making his bed. "You're not very far from the Foundation, you know. The Seychelles Union is almost surrounded by Federation territory. We have an ambassador and an enormous presence here, from consuls on down. The Seychellians like to oppose us in words, but they are usually very cautious about doing anything that gives us displeasure. Genoff, do turn in. We got nowhere today, and we have to do better tomorrow." Still, there was no difficulty in hearing between the two rooms, however, and when the ship was dark, Pellerat, tossing restlessly, finally said in a not very loud voice,
"Golan?"
"Yes?"
"You're not sleeping?"
"Not while you're talking."
"We did get somewhere today. Your friend Compor..."
"Ex-friend," growled Trevise.
"Whatever his status, he talked about Earth and told us something I hadn't come across in my researches before. Radioactivity."
Trevise lifted himself to one elbow. "Look, Golan, if Earth is really dead, that doesn't mean we return home. I still want to find Gaia." Tullerat made a puffing noise with his mouth as though he were blowing away feathers.
"My dear chap, of course, so do I. Nor do I think Earth is dead. Compor may have been telling what he felt was the truth, but there's scarcely a sector in the galaxy that doesn't have some tale or other that would place the origin of humanity on some local world, and they almost invariably call it Earth or some closely equivalent name. We call it globocentrism in anthropology. People have a tendency to take it for granted that they are better than their neighbors, that their culture is older and superior to that of other worlds, that what is good in other worlds has been borrowed from them, while what is bad is distorted or perverted in the borrowing or invented elsewhere. And the tendency is to equate superiority in quality with superiority in duration. If they cannot reasonably maintain their own planet to be Earth or its equivalent and the beginnings of the human species, they almost always do the best they can by placing Earth in their own sector, even when they cannot locate it exactly." Trevise said, "And you're telling me that Compor was just following the common habit when he said Earth existed in the Sirius sector? Still, the Sirius sector does have a long history, so every world in it should be well known, and it should be easy to check the matter even without going there." Pellerat chuckled. "Even if you were to show that no world in the Sirius sector could possibly be Earth, that wouldn't help. You underestimate the depths to which mysticism can bury rationality, Golan. There are at least half a dozen sectors in the galaxy where respectable scholars repeat, with every appearance of solemnity and with no trace of a smile, local tales that Earth, or whatever they choose to call it, is located in hyperspace and cannot be reached except by accident."
"And do they say anyone has ever reached it by accident?"
"There are always tales, and there was always a patriotic refusal to disbelieve, even though the tales are never in the least credible, and are never believed by anyone not of the world that produces them."
"Then, Genoff, let's not believe them ourselves. Let's enter our own private hyperspace of sleep."
"But, Golan, it's this business of Earth's radioactivity that interests me. To me, that seems to bear the mark of truth, or a kind of truth."
"What do you mean, a kind of truth?"
"Well, a world that is radioactive would be a world in which hard radiation would be present in higher concentration than is usual. The rate of mutation would be higher on such a world, and evolution would proceed more quickly and more diversely. I told you, if you remember, that among the points on which almost all the tales agree is that life on Earth was incredibly diverse, millions of species and all kinds of life. It is this diversity of life, this explosive development, that might have brought intelligence to the Earth, and then the surge outward into the galaxy. If Earth were for some reason radioactive, that is, more radioactive than other planets, that might account for everything else about Earth that is, or was, unique."
Trevise was silent for a moment. Then, "In the first place, we have no reason to believe Compor was telling the truth. He may well have been lying freely in order to induce us to leave this place and go chasing madly off to Sirius. I believe that's exactly what he was doing. And even if he were telling the truth, what he said was that there was so much radioactivity that life became impossible." Pellerat made the blowing gesture again.
"There wasn't too much radioactivity to allow life to develop on Earth, and it is easier for life to maintain itself once established than to develop in the first place. Granted, then, that life was established and maintained on Earth. Therefore, the level of radioactivity could not have been incompatible with life to begin with, and it can only have fallen off with time. There is nothing that can raise the level."
"Nuclear explosions?" suggested Trevise.
"What would that have to do with it?
I mean, suppose nuclear explosions took place on Earth.
On Earth's surface? Impossible.
There's no record in the history of the galaxy of any society being so foolish as to use nuclear explosions as a weapon of war. We would never have survived. During the Trigellian insurrections, when both sides were reduced to starvation and desperation, and when Gendiparis Korat suggested the initiation of a fusion reaction in...
He was hanged by the sailors of his own fleet. I know galactic history. I was thinking of accident.
There's no record of accidents of that sort that are capable of significantly raising the intensity of radioactivity of a planet, generally.
He sighed. I suppose that when we get around to it, we'll have to go to the Sirius sector and do a little prospecting there.
Someday, perhaps, we will. But for now...
Yes, yes. I'll stop talking.
He did. And Trevise lay in the dark for nearly an hour, considering whether he had attracted too much attention already, and whether it might not be wise to go to the Sirius sector and then return to Gaia when attention, everyone's attention, was elsewhere. He had arrived at no clear decision by the time he fell asleep. His dreams were troubled. 51. They did not arrive back in the city till mid-morning. The tourist center was quite crowded this time, but they managed to obtain the necessary directions to a reference library, where in turn they received instruction in the use of the local models of data-gathering computers. They went carefully through the museums and universities, beginning with those that were nearest, and checked out whatever information was available on anthropologists, archaeologists, and ancient historians. Pellaret said,
"Ah!"
"Ah," said Trevise with some asperity.
"Ah, what?" "This name Quintessence. It seems familiar."
"You know him?"
"No, of course not. But I may have read papers of his back at the ship where I have my reference collection."
"We're not going back, Genoff. If the name is familiar, that's a starting point. If he can't help us, he will undoubtedly be able to direct us further." He rose to his feet. "Let's find a way of getting to Seychelles University. And since there will be nobody there at lunchtime, let's eat first." It was not until late afternoon that they had made their way out to the university, worked their way through its maze, and found themselves in an anteroom waiting for a young woman who had gone off in search of information, and who might, or might not, lead them to Quintessence.
"I wonder," said Pellaret uneasily, "how much longer we'll have to wait. It must be getting toward the close of the school day."
And, as though that were a cue, the young lady whom they had last seen half an hour before walked rapidly toward them, her shoes glinting red and violet, and striking the ground with a sharp musical tone as she walked. The pitch varied with the speed and force of her steps. Pellaret winced. He supposed that each world had its own ways of assaulting the senses, just as each had its own smell. He wondered if, now that he no longer noticed the smell, he might also learn not to notice the cacophony of fashionable young women when they walked. She came to Pellaret and stopped.
"May I have your full name, Professor?"
"It's Genoff Pellaret, miss."
"Your home planet?"
Trevise began to lift one hand as though to enjoin silence, but Pellaret, either not seeing or not regarding, said, "Terminus." The young woman smiled broadly and looked pleased.
"When I told Professor Quintessence that a Professor Pellaret was inquiring for him, he said he would see you if you were Genoff Pellaret of Terminus, but not otherwise."
Pellaret blinked rapidly. You mean he's heard of me?"
"It certainly seems so."
And almost creakily, Pellaret managed to smile as he turned to Trevise.
"He's heard of me. I honestly didn't think... I mean, I've written very few papers, and I didn't think that anyone..." He shook his head. "They weren't really important."
"Well, then," said Trevise, smiling himself, "stop hugging yourself in an ecstasy of self-underestimation and let's go." He turned to the woman. "I presume, miss, there's some sort of transportation to take us to him?"
"It's within walking distance. You won't even have to leave the building complex, and I'll be glad to take you there. Are both of you from Terminus?"
And off she went. The two men followed, and Trevise said with a trace of annoyance, "Yes, we are. Does that make a difference?"
"Oh, no, of course not. There are people on Seychelles that don't like foundationers, you know, but here at the university we're more cosmopolitan than that. Live and let live is what I always say. I mean, foundationers are people, too. You know what I mean?"
"Yes, I know what you mean. Lots of us say that Seychellians are people."
"That's just the way it should be. I've never seen Terminus. It must be a big city."
"Actually, it isn't," said Trevise, matter-of-factly. "I suspect it's smaller than Seychelles City."
"You're tweaking my finger," she said. "It's the capital of the Foundation Federation, isn't it? I mean, there isn't another Terminus, is there?"
"No, there's only one Terminus, as far as I know, and that's where we're from, the capital of the Foundation Federation."
"Well, then, it must be an enormous city, and you're coming all the way here to see the professor? We're very proud of him, you know. He's considered the biggest authority in the whole galaxy.
Really? Said Trevise. On what?
Her eyes opened wide again. You are a teaser. He knows more about ancient history than I know about my own family.
And she continued to walk on ahead on her musical feet. One can only be called a teaser and a finger-tweaker so often without developing an actual impulse in that direction. Trevise smiled and said, The professor knows all about Earth, I suppose.
Earth?
She stopped at an office door and looked at them blankly. You know, the world where humanity got its start.
Oh, you mean the planet that was first? I guess so. I guess he should know all about it. After all, it's located in the Seychelles sector. Everyone knows that. This is his office. Let me signal him.
Oh, no, don't, said Trevise, not for just a minute. Tell me about Earth.
Actually, I never heard anyone call it Earth. I suppose that's a foundation word. We call it Gaia here.
Trevise cast a swift look at Pellaret. Oh, and where is it located?
Nowhere. It's in hyperspace, and there's no way anyone can get to it. When I was a little girl, my grandmother said that Gaia was once in real space, but it was so disgusted at the...
Crimes and stupidities of human beings, muttered Pellaret,
that, out of shame, it left space and refused to have anything more to do with the human beings it had sent out into the galaxy. You know the story, then. See? A girlfriend of mine says it's superstition. Well, I'll tell her, if it's good enough for professors from the Foundation.
A glittering section of lettering on the smoky glass of the door read, Sotain Quintessets Ept, in the hard-to-read Seychellian calligraphy, and under it was printed in the same fashion, Department of Ancient History. The woman placed her finger on a smooth metal circle. There was no sound, but the smokiness of the glass turned a milky white for a moment, and a soft voice said in an abstracted way, Identify yourself, please.
Janoff Pellaret of Terminus, said Pellaret, with Golan Trevise of the same world.
The door swung open at once. 52. The man who stood up, walked around his desk, and advanced to meet them was tall and well into middle age. He was light brown in skin color, and his hair, which was set in crisp curls over his head, was iron gray. He held out his hand in greeting, and his voice was soft and low. I am S.Q. I am delighted to meet you, professors. Trevise said, I don't own an academic title. I merely accompany Professor Pellaret. You may call me simply Trevise. I am pleased to meet you, Professor Abt. Quintessets held up one hand in clear embarrassment. Oh, no. Abt is merely a foolish title of some sort that has no significance outside of Seychelles. Ignore it, please, and call me S.Q. We tend to use initials in ordinary social intercourse on Seychelles. I'm so pleased to meet two of you, when I had been expecting but one.
He seemed to hesitate a moment, then extended his right hand, after wiping it unobtrusively on his trousers.
Trevise took it, wondering what the proper Seychellian manner of greeting was.
Quintessett said, Please sit down. I'm afraid you'll find these chairs to be lifeless ones, but I, for one, don't want my chairs to hug me. It's all the fashion for chairs to hug you nowadays, but I prefer a hug to mean something, eh?